We've been for a year in Ezekiel, major prophet with 48 chapters. I have was going to preach one more sermon I told you last week in the book of Ezekiel, and that ends up not being the truth because I'm not going to. I read over chapters 40 through 48 early in the week, and I said, I've really said everything I want to say. I could talk about the division of the land, and I could have shown you a chart, a map of where the children of Israel will be divided in the millennial kingdom. We could have talked about the river that will flow eastward out of the temple and how that's going to rejuvenate the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea will be alive, and the water from the Dead Sea will clean and freshen and be the food sustenance of the waters of the world, really, after the destruction of the tribulation period. That'll be necessary. And there will be wonderful, awesome water that will create all kinds of food coming from the underneath the temple. But as I looked at those things in those chapters of Ezekiel, there wasn't really an application. There wasn't really a sermon that I wanted to preach. And so about halfway through the week, I said, nope, I'm going to go to my next series. And the next series is about money. We're going to talk about giving. Now, let me do kind of a cushion here. See, Tim got up and walked out just like that. I talk about money and, you know, and the sad thing is he's our ministry committee designee as the chairman of the finance committee. So that's a bad thing. It's a bad sign. As you know, most of you anyway, 95% of the teaching and preaching here at Trinity Baptist Church, the scope and sequence, is driven by books of the Bible. We choose a book kind of based on where we've been and where we haven't been. And the next big book we're going to get into is Matthew, which will happen about Christmas time. Every once in a while, though, we do go to topical series. But most of our preaching and teaching is driven by these book studies. I think something, a practice that makes our church unique, maybe even different. I know some don't like it. From time to time, people say, that's boring, and they go someplace else to church. We believe this is best. I last did a series on giving on this topic in 2004, and again before that in 1995. Some churches talk a lot about money. I know there are some churches that have a whole month every year just to talk about stewardship. They call it their stewardship campaign, their stewardship month, and they will have every sermon on everything they do is about money for that month or that period of time. We haven't done that here. I've heard other people say, I'm going to this church, and it would be a good church, except every sermon is either about getting saved, getting other people saved, or giving money to the church. And then they start over again. Get saved, bring other people to church, and give money to the church. And that's all they talk about, those three topics. We don't do that. We try to teach what the Word of God says, and it's much bigger than that. To the extent that sometimes in past committee meetings and men's meetings and even private conversation, I'll have people from this church say to me, Pastor, you need to talk more about giving. You need to talk more about money. So we don't talk a lot about it, a whole lot. It's two reasons, I think. One, that we let the Bible drive our topics, and I've already said that. And two, I really believe that giving should not be something that's based upon emotion or based upon guilt. But giving to our church should really be based upon Bible principles. Think with me. If mature Christians, obeying God's word, give as they ought to, and the church then spends money as God would have it give, there will always be enough. If there's not enough money, then one of two things are true. Either God's people are immaturely not obeying God, not giving what they ought to give, or the church is spending money in ways it ought not spend money. One of those two things is true. And sometimes I think in a possibility of combination of both. In looking back at my previous notes, I see that I tell a lot more jokes when I'm talking about money than most subjects. And I think it's kind of like talking about sex. We find it very uncomfortable and very personal, so we poke fun so as to lighten the air a little bit. I think giving is uncomfortable to preach and to listen to for a couple of reasons. One, I benefit directly from the giving of Trinity Baptist Church. My salary comes from the offering plates. It's kind of a no-brainer, and growing up in a parsonage, it's always been true. And I think there's a second reason, maybe it's a difficult subject to preach and to listen to, is that it's so objective. I mean, if we're talking about lying, you can kind of, well, is it a white lie? Is it a, you know, what kind of a lie is it? If we're talking about thoughts, well, nobody really knows what I'm thinking. When we're talking about money, both you and your wife, your spouse, know exactly where you're at. And so when I preach the next few weeks, you have three options as I see them. You can either ignore what I say and endure it, or you could decide you're going to change, or you could decide you could leave the church. Basically, if you don't agree, those are kind of the options that you're going to have. I hope that you will, in your heart, as a priest before God, it would be my agenda to preach Bible principles on giving, a theology, if you will, on giving over the next several weeks. And it would be my hope that you would then, as a priest before God, we all are that we all have that responsibility, that you will decide to prove yourself right. That you will prove yourself right in your own mind. Now, you don't have to prove me wrong. You don't have to prove yourself right to me. But what each of us needs to do is prove ourselves right to ourselves, that we have an understanding of what God is teaching on this topic of giving and that we are practicing it. We all ought to obey what we believe the Bible teaches on this topic as well as any other topic. I begin this series with what I'm going to call the principle of the first fruits. Let me read just a couple of verses from Exodus 22. I read, and these references are all listed there in your Bible. You could keep up with me. We're going to turn to some of them, or listed on your notes, rather. Exodus 22, I read, "You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me." From Proverbs 3, 9 and 10, "Honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. So shall your barns be filled with plenty and your vats overflow with new wine." In the beginning, God created. The first acts of creation were a man, or the final acts of creation, rather, were a man and a woman. We do not believe that we are an evolutionary byproduct of Mother Earth. God then planted a garden for Adam and Eve, and God gave Adam the responsibility of caring for the garden. The earth was man's to enjoy. In this garden, God gave man one restriction, one rule. And man broke that one rule. Now, I know why man broke that rule. It's because we like breaking rules. It's who we are. You get a boundary and you got to see how close you can get to the edge. That's just who we are. But I have often, ever since I was a teenager in church and listened to that story, I had to ask myself, why did God do what God did? I mean, I understand why Adam did what Adam did. He was tempted and he made a wrong decision. But why did God do what God did? Why did he make a restriction? He could have said, you can enjoy every tree of the garden. Could he not have? Or he could have said, you know, I'm going to have this one tree here that you can't touch, but I'm going to put it out there someplace. Why did God make a restriction? And then why did God put it so close to the children, to Adam and Eve, so that they... Why did he do that? Another story. God had just brought the children of Israel to the promised land. God promised Israel that they would eat the spoils of their victories, that as they were given one military victory after another, that they would enjoy those benefits, that they would live in houses that they had not built, that they would wear clothes that they had not made, that they would eat fruit from trees that they had not planted. God parted the Jordan River in a mighty, mighty way, and then he gave Joshua a battle plan for the first city, the city of Jericho. For 6 days, they were to walk around the city once each day, and then on the seventh day, they were to walk around the city seven times. And on the 13th time, after they'd walked around the city for the 13th time, The priest would blow a trumpet, and the city would implode, and it did. The city imploded upon itself, and the children of Israel, the men of war, were directed to go into the city of Jericho and completely destroy it. In this city, they were to kill everything. They were to kill every man, every woman, every child. They were to kill all the animals. They were to completely destroy this city, and the only thing they were supposed to take from this city was the gold, the silver, the bronze, the hard currency stuff, the metal stuff. They were to bring that to the tabernacle. And you remember what happened. There was one man who did not do what he was supposed to do. One man named Achan went in there, and he saw, coveted, took, and hid a beautiful piece of clothing and some gold and some silver. In the next battle against Ai, 36 men died, and God told Joshua that Israel had sinned. God then pointed his finger at Achan. In judgment for his crimes, Achan, his wife, his children, his cattle, and everything he owned, was first stoned, then burned, and then buried between a pile of rubble. The whole nation of Israel suffered greatly because of the sin of that one man. And again, I ask the question, I know why Achan did what he did. He saw it, he wanted it, he took it, it was wrong. I understand Achan, but again I ask this question. Why did God do what God did? God had told Israel that the place was theirs, that they were going to enjoy it all. Why in this case? And you say, well, maybe the church needed the money. No, the tabernacle was already built, and in the offerings for the tabernacle, there had come a point where Moses had directed the people, stop bringing gold and silver into the tabernacle. We have more than enough. We don't need any more wool. We don't need any more seal skins. We don't need any more gold. No more of this beautiful wood you're bringing. Nothing else. We've got plenty. So it was not a case of the tabernacle needing more cash. That's not why God did this. Why did God do this? Why did he allow Israel to have free access to all the wealth of this awesome trading city that was Jericho and not let them have any of it? In both these two cases, the Garden of Eden and in Jericho, I think I see a pattern. God owned the garden. He had created it. He had planted it. And as the creator, God could have said, everything in this garden is mine. Adam and Eve, see that one tree over there? That's yours. I'm going to give you that tree out of the goodness of my heart. You can eat out of that one tree. But God didn't. In his grace and in his mercy, God had given them an abundant yes and a solitary no. I remember the first time I heard that phrase was from Dr. Les Olala at family camp 148 years ago. And he was teaching on parenting. And he said, God gave Adam and Eve an abundant yes and a solitary no, and that's how we ought to parent. Good philosophy. That was free. That's extra. That's not in the sermon. All right. That's what God did. He gave the children of Israel, I mean, he gave Adam and Eve, his children of Israel on the brain, he gave Adam and Eve every tree of the garden but one. And again, I ask, why that one? When man violated that one law in the garden, he was effectively saying, I am God of this garden. I am the authority. I will make a decision of what I will have and what I will not have. I have no allegiance to anyone but me. I reserve the right to make the final decisions in my life. You say, no, that's not the way it happened, Pastor. The way it happened was there was this beautiful woman that God had already given to Adam, and she was deceived by this beautiful tree and this sneaky person, this snake, and therefore she took it because she was deceived, and she gave it to Adam, and he gave in to her. But yes, that is what happened. But in giving in to her, Adam made a choice of the will. He made a purposeful thing of his own volition where he said, I know what God has commanded me. And I'm going to disregard it. And I'm going to be the God. I'm going to be the Lord. I'm going to be the one that makes these decisions in my life. I am going to be in charge of myself. Adam's choice to do that day was a choice of self-worship. Adam became a practicing atheist. An amazing thing that a person who had walked with God could be an atheist, but that's what he was. I believe it could be argued that the first sin of rebellion was the sin of man taking for himself what God, Jehovah God, had reserved for himself. When God brought the children of Israel to Canaan, the same thing was the case. It was his land. It was the promised land. It was the land that belonged to him. And God had given that land that he set his eyes on, that he set his affection on. God promised that land to Adam and to Isaac and to Jacob and to the children of Israel. And he says, this is my land. I'm going to give it to you. And I believe when he said, this city Jericho now, the gold belongs to me. The silver belongs to me. I want you to utterly destroy everything else in it. I believe God was again saying, the land's mine. I can tell you what city you will live in and what city you will not live in. I can do that because I am the God that created this. This is my land. And if you take what is designated for mine, it's stealing. You're taking from me. Achan violated God's divine right to own the promised land. I believe both of these teach us and point to something that I would call the principle of the first fruit, or the principles of the first fruits. And here it is in your notes. The sentence reads like this: by giving the first, we acknowledge that everything we are and have belongs to God. By giving the first, we acknowledge that everything we are and have belongs to God. I don't give to God because he needs money. God owns it all. I don't give to God because he is cruel and mean. No, God has given me an abundant yes and a solitary no. That breath was free and it was from God. This life I live is free and it's from God. I have an abundant life. I get all these things. I'm surrounded with good gifts from God. But by putting God first in my time, in my treasures, in my thoughts, what I'm saying is that everything I have and everything that I am really belongs to God. Now, I told Pastor Rory that I was going to use the T word this week. Here it comes. I think tithing is, in effect, first fruit giving. Tithing is a kind of first fruit giving. Now, some people may say, and you'd be right, the word tithe is never used by Paul in his instructions to the church. That's true. If you Google the word tithe, and I did this week, you will find all kinds of websites on tithing. And for every website that is emphatic and teaches thou shalt tithe, there's another website out there that's equally emphatic and equally impassionate that'll say something like this: tithing is a wicked, evil thing that the church has invented for the purpose of owning and controlling poor people. And those websites are out there in abound. There's two hugely different positions. One, God tells us to tithe, we all ought to tithe. The other side is, God never put tithing in the church, we ought not do it. And churches that teach that are really robbing and misleading people. I think we need to look and see, what does the Bible really say about tithing? The first time tithing is mentioned in the Bible, and the law of first mention matters, is Genesis chapter 14. Look there with me. Three short verses in Genesis 14. It's the first mention of tithing in the Bible. It's the story of Abraham. He's been out and he just defeated the four kings that attacked and took away his nephew Lot. And now he's bringing back all the spoils of that war. So he and his 318 servants go out. They whip up on these kings. Now they're bringing back all the proceeds. They got clothes and they got idols and they got gold. And they're bringing all this back. And as they bring it back, this event happens. Verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him, Abraham, and said, blessed be Abraham, be Abram, of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he, and we know from the book of Hebrews that this he has to be Abraham, he gave him, Melchizedek, a tithe of all. That's it. First mention of tithing in the Bible. Well, there's not enough here. But this just begs so many questions. Psalm 110, where it talks about Melchizedek and Christ being after the Melchizedek priesthood. Hebrews 7, 8, 9, 10, especially Hebrews 7, do give us some light on this story. But this story begs so many questions. One question, did Abram know this Melchizedek guy before this day? I mean, had they met? Abram was a large real estate, but he was a very wealthy man, did a lot of business and trading in that part of the country. And Melchizedek was king of Salem. All right, did the king of Salem ever meet with Melchizedek before this? A priest of the Most High God, was there a form of worship that Melchizedek was in charge of and that Abraham had submitted to Melchizedek before? And had Melchizedek, as in charge of that, asked for a tithe before from Abraham? We never hear any place else that Abraham tithes. Never before, never afterwards. It's not that he didn't. It's just there's no mention of it in Scripture. We have no other story but this story in these three verses. I've often thought that perhaps Abraham recognized Melchizedek as God, as the same guy who had come to Abraham in the first place back in chapter 12 in Ur and Haran and asked him to come out and go to the promised land. And that the guy that visited with Abraham, actually that happens after this, when they were promising that within a year Isaac would be born, maybe Abraham recognized Melchizedek as Jesus, as God, and therefore he did this. But then there's another question. Why the response? Melchizedek comes out, and he gives bread and wine. Well, that's understanding. You got these people coming back from war. They're tired. They're thirsty. They need a good banquet. And so Melchizedek has the produce, and he feeds them. Melchizedek blesses Abraham. Okay, that's understandable. He's priest of the Most High God, and obviously Abraham looks up to him. But why the last phrase? And he, Abraham, gave Melchizedek a tithe of all. Why a tithe? Why not a fifth, or a sixth, or a ninth, or a twelfth? And why did he give him anything? Why was this the response of Abraham? Here comes this king of Salem out, and he says, blessed be Abram, who's had this great success. I'm going to bless you, Abraham. And by the way, here's food for your guys. And then Abraham's response is, oh, God has blessed me. Here's a tenth of everything he's just blessed me with. I'm going to give it to you, Melchizedek. Why in the world did Abraham come up with that idea? Was this completely spontaneous? Was it completely off the cuff? Was this just something that Abraham made up? A couple things we do know. This was voluntary. You would have to read a whole lot into the text to say that Melchizedek was somehow Abram's sovereign and had demanded such a tithe. And that you also know from the text that Abraham did this in response to the blessing of God, the good success he had enjoyed. But the other questions remain unanswered, or the questions that we would have remain unanswered. Secular history might give us some clues to Abraham's behavior. As we go back in archaeology and secular history, we know that the Sumerians, those farmers did give a tithe, a 10% of their produce to their government agencies, and their government agencies primarily used that money for the support of government-sponsored temples. There was a website that I picked this up from and also read similar stuff in a 50-year-old book I have. Here's from the website. Giving a tithe, as history tells us, was a common practice among most, if not all, ancient Near East cultures, such as Babylon, Persia, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Syria, and even as far east as China. For them, it was a royal tax, a service to their gods. So maybe the reason Abraham responded in this way was because this is the way he had been taught as a kid. Growing up in Ur of the Chaldees, it was natural to respond in such a way. This was the law. Okay. Well, if that's true, if this is the way Abraham was taught when he was a kid, where did that come from? Well, for a possible answer, why don't you come back even further with me to Genesis chapter 4. First sin is in Genesis chapter 3. The first act of human worship, the first formal worship of any kind that we find in the Bible is Genesis chapter 4. It's the story of Cain and Abel. I kind of think that there was a worship service in chapter 3, that somehow God sacrificed an animal and taught Adam and Eve, this is why I'm doing this, this is for you, it was part of the messianic message that he gave them. I kind of think that, but I have to read that into the text. It's not there. So we come now to Genesis chapter 4, and why did Cain and Abel bring a sacrifice in the first place? Again, you have to read it into the text. It doesn't tell us why. It just says that they did it. There's no place before this where we have instructions from God to Adam and then therefore to Cain and Abel. No, no. You have to read that into the text. And so it's very natural for us to take Moses' law, which is 2,500 years after this, and read that into the text, or even the writing of the book of Hebrews, which was over 4,000 years after this, and read this text. And really, that is not a good exegetical process, to take something that would be written 4,000 years later and say, this is why this happened, because of this 4,000. You say, well, God wrote it all. Yeah, but it's not great theology building when you do this. So we have to ask the questions then, why did Cain and Abel do this? And I can only, the only assumption is that there must have been something that God told Adam that Adam had indeed shared with Cain and Abel. Well, what was that something? Well, maybe the things in the text will help us with that. Look at verse 2. And she bore again this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. We got two boys. One does produce, the other does shepherding, does animal husbandry. And in the process of time, says in my New King James, your King James, if you're carrying an ESV today, it probably says at the end of days. That is a more literal translation of this text, at the end of days. Could be the idea of at an end of an appointed amount of days. Perhaps this speaks of the Sabbath. I've heard that taught. Maybe it speaks of a solstice, a new moon. I don't know. But there was an appointed time. I get that impression from the phrase at the end of the days. At the end of this certain amount of days, something happened here. It came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. Now, I understand that this is the idea of Cain brought from what he had. He brought, here's what he had. He took some of it and brought it, okay? Abel, it says, he brought of the firstborn and of their fat. The idea there is he brought of the best of the best. He took not only the firstborn, but he took the best firstborn. He took the fattest of the fattest, the bestest of the bestest, the first fruit of the first fruit. That's what Abel brought when he was going to bring his sacrifice to the Lord. And then it says, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering. But he did not respect Cain and his offering. Now, how exactly did God show his approval or his lack of approval of these sacrifices? And again, we have to read into the text. It doesn't say. Did God just show up and say, hey, Cain, not so good. Abel, I really, really like what you did. I think what happened here is the same thing that happened we talked about last week. Remember when the glory of the Lord came? God did a wonderful thing. There were several times in the Bible where God lit the fire. We know about Samson and Manoah. God lit the fire. Could it be that God lit the fire? Cain makes his sacrifice. Abel makes his sacrifice. And like Elijah on Mount Carmel, God lights the fire over here. And Cain is left over here with drying vegetables. Okay, there's a nice fire going on over here. God respects Abel and his sacrifice. Cain, not so much. And so Cain's ticked. Cain's angry. That was his natural response, and his countenance fell. It showed up in his face. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why is your countenance fallen? Well, because he's upset. His brother has shown him up. Then it says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door. What does it mean, do well? And here's why I have brought us to this text. We often assume that the reason God respected Abel's sacrifice and not Cain, and this is what I've always thought, was because Abel's was a blood sacrifice, Cain was not. Therefore, God respected Abel. And again, though, we're reading Moses and the book of Hebrews into the text. If we did not have the rest of the Bible, why would God respect Abel and not Cain? If we just had this text, why? And the only hint would have to be here in this phrase where God says, if you do well. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, and it was done before Christ. Jesus quotes, and the apostles often quote from that translation, that Greek translation. I understand that the Septuagint says something like this. If you divide correctly, if you rightly divide, then you will be accepted. That word divide, then, that the word that is used in the Septuagint in this text, is the same word that is used in Luke chapter 15 about the father who divides his inheritance between his son. It's the same word also that God uses in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 when it talks about the Holy Spirit dividing spiritual gifts. So the idea of separating, of saying, here, you take this and you take this. If you divide correctly, if you don't divide correctly, if you don't rightly divide this, then that's sin. That's what's waiting for you. Perhaps Cain's great sin was not in not offering a blood sacrifice. Perhaps Cain's great sin was with holding his best, not putting his first fruit out there, not doing what God had said. There's some hint to that too in Hebrews chapter 11, where it talks about the fact that Abel's sacrifice in Hebrews chapter 11 verse 4 was a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. More excellent, I understand from Vine's dictionary, that word excellent, the idea of an amount is in mind. Like Abel gave more than Cain did. That Cain brought a sacrifice, but he didn't bring the more. He didn't rightly divide. He didn't bring enough. So now I'm going to read into the text. Perhaps Abraham and his contemporary ancients tithed on spoils of war and annual increases because of instructions that God gave to Adam and that Adam gave to his sons. Maybe tithing is as ancient as the Garden of Eden. The idea that God would say to Adam and Eve, okay, you blew it. You took that tree that I had designated as mine. Now I'm going to tell you what you're going to do from now on. If you would obey me, if you would love me, if you would do what I would have you to do, then as you increase, as your wealth increases in this world, remember that I get the first. I get the tithe. I get the first 10%. I get it off the top. I get the cream. It belongs to me. And if you do that, then it will show your worship for me. It'll show that you're putting me first. Most Bible students agree that in the Mosaic Law, there were three tithes. I'm not going to read these texts. I've listed for them for you here. I've got them printed out, but I'm going to save some time and not do this. Of these three tithes, they are different. Israel had three tithes. The first one, the Lord's tithe, was for the care of the Levites and the priests. There's a couple passages in Deuteronomy, one in Deuteronomy 12, one in Deuteronomy 14. The chapter that Charlie read this morning was all about this tithe. Remember, the chapter started out with God telling Aaron, okay, you bear the burden of the sanctuary. It's your problem. You're in charge of it. And if things don't go right in the sanctuary, it's your doing. Now, then he starts in verse 8, and the rest of the chapter, he talks about what Aaron's going to get. And he says, okay, when Israel has an increase, when they tithe, when they have an increase and they bring in their tithes, they offer a heave offering. That does not mean they puked, okay? Does not mean that you gorge yourself, and that's not what's going on there, all right? What a heave offering was, that they would take that and they would lift it up before the Lord. They would come into the temple, the tabernacle, and they say, God, here's the tithe, here's the 10% of what you gave me. And then they would leave it there, because the tithe is the Lord's. And that's what the Levites would live off of, the 10% of the people, what the people brought, especially the Levites that would be there at the temple at that time, working there 30 days on and 60 days off period of time. Then the Levites, they were supposed to go through that tithe stuff and take the 10% that was the best of the best, okay? Children of Israel brought the best 10% in. Now the Levites would take the 10% of the 10%, in other words, 1%, and they would turn around and offer a second tithe, or they would offer a tithe to the priests. And that's how the priest made his living. He got a tenth of the Levite stuff. The Levites got a tenth of everything else. That's why they weren't allowed to own real estate, because they lived off the tithe. And so when he says the tithe is the Lord's in Leviticus chapter 30, 27 to 30, and therefore you can't touch it. It doesn't belong to you. It's not yours. You can't do anything with it. That tithe was for the care of the Levites and the priests. We'll talk more about in giving to come the purpose of the money and why we should give money to church. But one of the things that we do see in the New Testament is the fact that Paul defends the right of a preacher to make a living by preaching, that a pastor should be taken care of by the people who he serves, and that this Judea is a principle that we see in the people of Judah, the people of Israel. A second tithe that they were to give, a second annual tithe, was a festival tithe. I'm going to read
part of this one. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 5 to 7. But you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all to which you have put your hand, you and your households, in the which the Lord your God has blessed you. The second tithe is for the use of the celebration of God. It was for their use in worship. I think it would be appropriate to say that this tithe could be what we use to take care of this building. We have a tithe that's for the Levites and the priests. Okay, that's to take care of those that minister. That belongs to God. We don't mess with that. But then there's another tithe, and it belongs to taking care of our worship. Here's what they would do. This tithe, I'm going to give to the Levites. Now, this tithe, I'm going to put it in a pile over here. And I'm going to put it in this pile. And when the day comes that we head off to Jerusalem, when that day comes, that's what we're going to use. And another place, he says something like this. If it's too much, if it's too far to take your cows and your oats and all your stuff with you, then what you should do is sell it, turn it into gold, turn it into cash, turn it into money, take that to Jerusalem, and then buy whatever you need to celebrate. They were supposed to take a tithe, and then three times a year, for a week at a time, everybody was supposed to come to Jerusalem. And they would celebrate with the people of God three times a year for a week. I wish we did this. I wish it was part of our culture. Wouldn't it be cool? I think it would be. Friday night, Lynn and I went to community church because the Great Lakes Baptist Conference was having, they now call it Converge GL, Converge Great Lakes, was having its annual meeting there. And I had found out that it was going to be there from Pastor Ken Nabi because Crawford Loritz, who I've gotten to know from the Art of Marriage stuff and from the Stepping Up videos that we've watched on Saturday mornings, I've come to really appreciate Crawford Loritz. He was going to be there to preach. And so Lynn and I went to the service just so we could hear Crawford Loritz. And there's other things I'm not going to tell you about. But in Dr. Loritz's sermon, he talked about community and the importance of the church. And that you can't be a Christian unless you're part of a church that is not just sitting there and listening, but is sitting there listening and then acting out among ourselves. He says, we think fellowship is pie and coffee. That's not fellowship. Fellowship is sharing the word one with another. Fellowship is an accountability that is in community together. We need that. And the children of Israel, they did that three times a year. They all left their homes, and they traveled together, and they sang psalms as they went. Remember the story about Jesus getting lost in the crowd? It was a party, man. They would bring all their stuff. A tenth of their income was for these three events. They would take all their stuff, and they'd bring it there, and they would eat, and they would talk about the Lord, and they would listen to, yeah, they'd listen to preaching. But they sang, and they had fun. It was like, you know, family camp ratcheted up three times a year. Talk about getting to know your cousins and your friends in a way. And it didn't matter if they were on the other side of Outer Slobodi. Once a year, three times a year, you were going to show up and get to see them again. They had something. And a tenth of their income was for making sure this happened. And they were to make sure the Levites and the widows and the poor kids weren't left out. If you didn't have the money to go, that was the problem of your rich neighbor, to make sure that you had the money to go and that you had the money to make a good time. Well, there's a third tithe, not only the Lord's tithe, but the festival tithe, but then there was a benevolent tithe. Every third year, Israel was supposed to set aside a tithe every third year. So it wasn't an every year tithe. So now we're 10%, 20%, now another 3.5%. So when we talk about a tithe in this case, remember there was no federal tax money. Sometimes the king did take other stuff in years to come. But that 10% was to take care of the ministers at the temple. 10% was so that we can celebrate and worship together. And now another 3.5% or 3 1/3% was for the poor people. That I have this right, listen to Josephus, Jewish historian. Besides these two tithes, which I've already said you are to pay every year, the one to the Levites and the one other for the festivals, you are to bring every third year a tithe to be distributed to those that want, to women also that are widows and to children that are orphans. This idea that the church should tithe was taught by the early church fathers. I found both in book and websites, Origen, Augustine, Cyprian of Carthage, Irenaeus, Ambrose, Jerome. I could bring quotes from all these. John Chrysostom says this, Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. In this way, he became teacher to all men that by way of declaring their gratitude, they should offer the first fruits of those things which God granted to them. If it were a dangerous thing for Jews to fail in giving tithes, then surely it is much more dangerous now. Well, you're sitting here listening to this and you say, okay, Pastor, that was the law. We have to pay Social Security. We have to pay taxes. We have to make sure the governor gets his 5.5% every time we buy an ice cream cone. What's with this for us? Well, as I said, Paul says nothing about the church and tithing. He does talk about giving, and we'll get back to that. Jesus mentions tithing twice, both times negatively. One time he talks about a bragging Pharisee, and a second time he says this, Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, those are just spices, little things, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done, justice, mercy, and faith, without leaving the others undone. Did you hear that? Jesus said of the Pharisees, you know, you guys are so worried, you're tithing on your anise. Come on. You should do that. Jesus does not diminish like he does the Sabbath, the tithe. In fact, if anything, in a backhanded way, Jesus commends it. Trinity Baptist Church has never sent out letters demanding payment of tithes or payment of dues. Never. And we won't. Officers of Trinity Baptist Church have never visited anyone's house for the purpose of asking a member for a pledge or why haven't you paid your pledge. We don't make passionate pleas at every offering trip and work up guilt trips in every sermon concerning money. Trinity Baptist Church does not believe that those who give to Trinity Baptist Church will always be healthy, wealthy, and happy. Let me say that one again. Trinity Baptist Church does not believe that those who give to Trinity Baptist Church will always be healthy, wealthy, and happy. That's a lie. Okay? I know a lot of people who give tithes to Trinity Baptist Church who are sick, poor, and grumpy. So I know that's a lie. And anyone who says we talk about money all the time at Trinity Baptist Church is either has a very paranoid, hyperactive conscience or hasn't been here very much, because we just don't. Okay, so what about this tithe thing or this tithe thing or whatever you want to call it? Well, the Bible does talk about money. And there is a principle in the Bible, I believe, that goes all the way back to whatever God said to Adam and Eve. And I believe that that process was laid out for the Jews in a very specific way, but that was their law. I do not believe that God zaps Christians who don't tithe and blesses Christians who do tithe. But you know, let me pull something from Daryl's Sunday school class. Daryl has taught us in the book of Job that Job is about how the righteous worship God, or rather, why the righteous worship God. And I would propose to you that by giving according to biblical principles, that's part of the way that we flesh out our worship of God. That if we would worship God, we do it by giving the first. We acknowledge that everything we are and have belongs to God.